On this week's 51%, we speak with psychologist Dr. Ingrid Clayton about her new book, Fawning, on how to unlearn the urge to people-please and start speaking up for yourself.
Start small. I literally say start with the next time someone says, what movie would you like to see? Don't just say, whatever you'd like to do. Ask yourself in that moment, how do I really feel?
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Most of us are aware of the three main survival/trauma responses. When we feel threatened, our instinct is often to fight, flee, or freeze. But our guest today has a new book on what she calls the fourth F, fawning. Fawning is when someone inexplicably draws closer to the thing or person that's causing them pain, usually when all their other options appear too dangerous or unavailable. Dr. Ingrid Clayton is a licensed clinical psychologist, trauma therapist, and complex trauma survivor with her own private practice in Southern California. A former fawner herself, Clayton says fawning is actually really common, even if we don't talk about it as much. When we do talk about fawning, she says it's often conflated with codependency or people-pleasing. Think of fawning as sort of an extreme. If you're someone who tends to brush off bad behavior or who apologizes to those who treat you wrong, you may be a fawner. And while some people value turning the other cheek, Clayton says fawning has a knack for keeping people in abusive situations and unhealthy relationships. Luckily, it is possible to stop being a fawner, although Clayton says it can take practice and patience. Her new book, Fawning, gives readers advice on how to start putting themselves first.
Most of us have heard of fight, flight, or freeze. These are the trauma responses that we've long known. But fawning is an extension of these. And sometimes it's referred to as the please and appease response. But it's a relational trauma response where we either caretake or appease someone in order to minimize harm. And the harm could be physical harm, emotional harm, financial security, or it could be a threat to the relationship itself, right? So most of us have these vital relationships in our lives, whether it's family of origin or partner or your boss, even communities in which we belong. And they feel like these relationships sort of hold our whole life intact. And so to threaten the safety and the attachment of these relationships can feel like we have a whole lot to lose. And so fawning comes in to sort of seek connection as a sense of protection. And one way I talk about it is this sense of we're seeking safety, right? It's a survival response. We're seeking safety almost over our own sense of autonomy and self.
I gotta say, this is my first time hearing about fawning. Where did the actual term fawning come from?
Pete Walker coined the term, and he is a psychotherapist who works with complex trauma. Complex trauma is synonymous with relational trauma. You know, I think in part he did it for the alliteration, fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. But it is extending that sort of old school definition, which I think can evoke sort of a brown nosing connotation, and really putting fawning in a trauma-informed lens, which means that this is an instinctual, unconscious response. It is nervous system based. So we do not choose fawning. Fawning is often sort of the last house on the block. It arises when fight, flight, or freeze are either not available to us or would make things worse. And if you think about things like childhood trauma, for instance, a child fighting back, it's going to make things worse, right? Where are they meant to flee or run? It's often not available to them. So when you have to navigate day in, day out, these systems of power, these hierarchies where you are dependent on others in order to essentially survive, fawning comes in to mitigate all of those complexities.
Obviously, every situation is different, but give me some examples of what fawning might look like. How do you distinguish fawning from just, you know, being patient or helpful around others?
It's a great question. So there are many different symptoms and it's context dependent, right? So it might look different in one relationship versus another, but some common signs are fawners tend to minimize themselves. And that can be we get physically sort of smaller, almost crouching down. We want to take up less space. Our voices might get quieter and softer, and we don't want to ruffle any feathers. But it also means our needs, wants, and opinions are minimized. So prioritizing everybody else's needs matter more. So that minimization is one piece. We tend to be conflict avoidant. Again, if fighting makes things worse, and this is true for myself and a lot of my clients that I've worked with over the years, conflict feels like life or death. So we are conflict avoidant, but many fawners wouldn't identify themselves as conflict avoidant. They would identify themselves as being helpful and empathic and kind. We tend to lean into these other attributes, which are wonderful attributes, but we don't know or understand the extent to which these have been hijacked, essentially, by our nervous system. To the point that we're often abandoning ourselves and our own needs and we don't even know it. There's also this sense of shape shifting. It's like, what does the environment need me to be? Who do I need to be in this context? So again, there's this pervasive thread under all the signs and symptoms, which in a long-term context equates to self-abandonment. So maybe you don't know who you are, what your opinions are, or you find that you don't have reciprocal relationships. You're often feeling resentful, like, why am I the one who always does all the heavy lifting and is managing, you know, the emotional lives of everyone, but no one's sort of showing up for me? Ultimately, it's because we are also not showing up for ourselves and we don't even know it.
You mentioned that fawning is kind of like an automatic last choice response compared to fight, flight, or freeze. In that sense, it kind of sounds like it's an unconscious behavior. So if you're not actively choosing to do it, I guess, how do you stop doing it?
Such a great question. And it's, you know, it's in part why I'm so passionate about bringing this lens and language to people, because although you might not see it in the moment, you might see it in hindsight. You might identify with some of these stories and symptoms and go, wait a second, you know what? I see myself reflected there. And I also think this approach of putting it in a trauma-informed paradigm reduces the stigma and the shame of behaviors that have long just been termed either people-pleasing or codependency. And as someone who, you know, lived in these paradigms for many years and was maybe even called controlling or what's wrong with you, just grow your self-esteem, why would you care what people think of you? These very conscious strategies aimed at just behavior change. I often felt not only shamed, but very stuck because people were telling me to do things that in my body, they did not feel available. Again, think about it in terms of a fight response, which is what healthy boundaries are, which is what having a voice essentially is a healthy aspect of a fight response. This was no longer available to me. So telling me to do something that my body felt like, no, 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 that raises the stakes and I will be annihilated, was deeply shaming and kept me stuck. And so we start to unpack this thing by, first of all, putting it in the context, both of our body in the nervous system, and the context that we live in, the genuine hierarchies, the way, you know, it's patriarchy, it's classism, it's racism, it's marginalized communities. We act as though everyone is on this reciprocal playing field, right? Like everyone has access to taking care of themselves. And the fact is, it's just not true, right? Fawning has been taught, it's been encouraged, it's been expected, it's been applauded, right? Particularly for women. It's not a gendered response, but a lot of women can see themselves and understand this fawn response. So when we start both to recognize it in hindsight and understand it as a trauma response, We can avail ourselves of tools beyond just this notion of, well, come on, Jesse, just raise your self-esteem. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if I could have done that, I would have done that. I didn't fawn because I didn't love myself. I fawned because I do, because it was this genius adaptation that was necessary. It was necessary day in and day out. And over time, it became almost fused with personality. So this is how we began to start to tease these things apart and start to find some freedom. And then, of course, I'm a trauma therapist, so I recommend, a trauma-informed therapist at the very least. And I certainly, in my book Fawning, I show seven very rich, very diverse, different case studies of what it looked like for these different individuals, because it's a very personal process, as you might imagine. If we're trying to reconnect to self, that process and that self is going to be very different depending on the person who's doing it.
Do you have any specific stories from your book that you would like to share with us?
So, my client Frances, I think, is a good example of someone who had childhood trauma and could identify that aspect of her story. But she was in a committed relationship where she did not think she was in an abusive relationship. She really believed she was with the love of her life. And yet, what I could see was that she was privileging and prioritizing her partner to such an extent that she could not see that his behaviors were abusive and manipulative, and that she was constantly in harm's way. And so, part of what can happen with fawning is we don't just convince the other people that everything's fine and it's all good, we literally convince ourselves. There's this disconnect from our own needs that we genuinely don't see or experience. So part of her coming to, and that's really what it looked like, what as she sort of touched into her own body, was noticing even the sensation, right? So if we're disconnected from self, I often say, what we talk about in trauma therapy is not what do you think about that and what is your opinion about that, but what are you experiencing right now? What are you noticing in your body? It might be sensation and it could be anything. It could actually be noticing that you feel disconnected, and that's a beautiful beginning, just witnessing that. But it starts to knit together this experience where her whole focus wasn't external, right? So for a fawner, our safety resides outside of our own body. Do you like me? Do you give me permission? Can you validate my experience? And we're moving that external focus into ourselves. So we're starting to establish this relationship to self for the first time. And as I saw Francis, over time sitting on my couch, moving from this narrative to like, no, it's all good. He's my partner. Nothing can disrupt this relationship. It's the most important thing in my life. As she was establishing a relationship to herself, and this could just make me so emotional thinking about it, she became the most important thing in her life for the first time ever. And as she grew this sense of self, just really through noticing and through curiosity, this is one of the most powerful tools that we have. She started to create this relationship with herself, that it's almost like you could see the scale sort of tipping, and suddenly she was at least just as much of a priority as was holding on to this vital relationship. And in that process, she could start to see, first only in my office, and then she would go back out into the world, and it was almost like the fog settled and she went back to this homeostasis. But eventually, she shared this experience where she was sitting on her own couch at home, and her partner was being very abusive. And it was like she touched into her own body and she felt and experienced what was happening in the present moment. And all this connection to self that she had developed on my couch in my office suddenly translated to sitting on her own couch at home. And she knew for herself, this is not okay, and I need to leave. Right. So this is an example in the context of an abusive relationship, but there are so many examples that we can point to from people in toxic work environments or maintaining really harmful relationships, even in family of origin or friendships, where they go, this person has never really been a friend back to me. Why do I continue to lean in? So fawning, not and unfawning, not only changes our relationship to self, but ultimately it changes our relationship to others.
I think it's beautiful the way you put that. You know, just that tipping of the scales where she became the most important relationship in her life. You know, because certainly as women, the opposite is emphasized to us from an early age. You know, we're told that your partner, your child, to some extent your job, those are the things that define you and what you should be like living for. And I do think there's a power in realizing that, oh, you know, I have value just as I am without all of those things too.
You know, I think the other thing that people often don't talk about because it's not as fun or sexy, but you know, when we say just set healthy boundaries, what we're also missing is that this piece of coming into ourselves and finding a genuine sense of value, it often feels bad and it feels wrong. People are filled with shame and guilt and like they're not being a good girl or a good daughter or a good friend. They feel like they're absolutely moving in the wrong direction, like they're selfish and they're mean, right? So these are some of the things that we have to wade through as we are growing this relationship to self. And ultimately, I say if you're feeling any of these things and you identify with some of these symptoms of being a long-term fawner, you're not moving in the wrong direction. You're finally moving in the right direction. And part of the work then is about growing our capacity to tolerate discomfort. And in this process, this is where we learn the difference between discomfort and danger. The body, if you have a history of trauma, relational trauma, is likely signaling danger at every turn. Don't go there. Don't speak up. It's going to make things worse. And we literally can't discern. And so this is part of the process of finally in our own body, in our own lives, being able to discern. This feels hard and it may feel horrible, but I'm growing my relationship to myself at the same time. And at the end of the day, that feels better than anything else I've ever tried before.
We're speaking with Dr. Ingrid Clayton, author of Fawning. It sounds like fawning often comes into play in abusive dynamics. When you're trying to do that work of setting boundaries and learning how to, I guess, unfawn, does it always necessitate having to remove yourself from the relationship or situation that is causing you to fawn first?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think a lot of my work is moving away from these all or nothing binary ideas, right? Healed or broken, right? Safe or unsafe, to be in relationship or not. I think there's so much gray area in between, and it's so personal and individual. That being said, my clients that I'm presenting and fawning, some of them do have to take physical, literal space from some of the relationships that are creating a sense of ongoing harm, right? If we think about trauma generally, it's like trying to recover from a war while you're outside in the battlefield every single day. You know what I mean? So oftentimes we do need to take some space, and that space can look different depending on the person. But at the other end of that spectrum, I think for some folks, they go, once they start to see that they had this reflexive response that was happening just out of the gates, no matter what, it starts to create a sense of possibility where there wasn't any possibility before. And they practice setting boundaries in a way that they find, I'm able to do this without leaving my job, without going no contact or some of these things. So it's so individual, and only the person who's doing it can decide what is best for them, what the time frame is. There's no one size fits all.
When you're setting boundaries, I guess, do you have advice for anyone who is learning how to do that on a regular basis for the first time? How do you go about setting boundaries in a way that's healthy and that sticks?
Start small. Do not go for the biggest boundary that you've always wanted to set but never could. And I say that quite seriously because what might happen if you go for the big boundary and it goes terribly wrong is you're just going to concretize in your body one more time. See, it's not safe, right? I can't have a voice. So I literally say start with the next time someone says, what movie would you like to see? Don't just say, whatever you'd like to do. Ask yourself in that moment, how do I really feel? Can I assert myself? Even if it's like that low stakes and you don't really care, force yourself to have an opinion, to put it forward and hold the line. If they bring you the wrong food or they forgot your side of mashed potatoes, see if you can call the waiter back and say, "Excuse me, I ordered mashed potatoes, right? Or this is the wrong thing, or it's cold." Practice in lower stakes. And what this does, we're literally creating a roadmap. It's like if this blueprint in our body that was never there before, so that the next time and the next time and the next time we're in a situation where things, we don't feel right and we need to have a voice, the body kind of goes, "Well, it wasn't all bad last time." It's like brick by brick, we're starting to build this sense of internal safety so that even when it doesn't go the way that we would hope, because that's not the point of boundaries. The point of boundaries is to protect ourselves no matter what. Even when it doesn't go well, essentially, we can still feel like that's okay. I protected myself and my peace and my values, and I didn't get steamrolled in the end, right? So starting small is helpful. And I also say, look for opportunities where, again, you're not leaning into a binary, like, "No, I'm not going to do that," but maybe, "I can't do it on Wednesday, but would Friday work for you?" Right? That you're sort of like amending. You collaborate with other people and you say, "This part doesn't feel good to me, but this is what I'm available for." Or are you open to sort of shifting what your expectation is? And I think that's a softer, easier way in for folks.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about your book, Fawning. Why did you decide to focus on this subject, and what do you hope readers get out of the book?
Oh my goodness. I'm focusing on this topic because I'm a lifelong fawner. And although I am a clinical psychologist who specializes in relational trauma, there was nothing until this framework that finally helped me to be more free. So, in other words, it was the last house on the block, and I had tried everything else and found it wanting. So, not only for myself and for myself at age 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, but for everyone else who needs this work and doesn't know it yet, I feel so passionate about sharing not only my own experience but that of my clinical practice. And I think one of the biggest things we touched on briefly, but the prior ways that we have talked about some of these behaviors have been so shaming, right? We've been called control freaks, and like I said, just low self-esteem, and we didn't have a low self-esteem problem, right? We had a body with hardwired instructions for maintaining relationship essentially at any cost, and our body did exactly what it was designed to do to keep us safe. And shaming a thing before we ever acknowledge its genius and helpful origins was really confusing for a lot of people. It was for me too, even though I didn't know that that's what it was. So I just feel like it's a kinder, more compassionate, more holistic, more available language and approach. And quite frankly, the results are more successful.
Now, is the book more of a guide or a collection of stories from former fawners?
I think it's a bit of a hybrid, right? So I did set out not to write a traditional self-help book, in part because I think my bias is that a lot of self-help books perform helpfulness in the sense of like, here's 10 tips and tools, right? And you go, "Well, I did all those 10 things and my life feels the same." And so I definitely want to honor that everyone's path is going to be different. That said, there are certain themes and principles and tools that might be helpful. And so I'm trying to lay those out and say, your path is going to probably be different than the person sitting next to you. And along those lines, it's why I invited so many of my clients to share their personal experience, because I believe in the power of teaching through story. And if we're talking about something, where we started today, which is you might not even know that you're living in a chronic trauma response, the way we start to see it is we witness it in somebody else and we go, "Oh, I had that experience and that's how I responded." And then we get to see that person move through that and find more freedom and flexibility. It's not only inspiring, but I think it's like a million little roadmaps that when your body starts to resonate To me, that's the indicator that that's probably the right tool for you. Give it a try. And I can't tell people what to do. In fact, if I really took that stance, I'd likely be prolonging a chronic fawn response because, once again, I have all the answers. I'm the expert, and you don't really know what to do or how to do it or how to be in contact with your own body, your values, your opinions. And I want to actually give people the tools so that they can build up their own sense of expertise and authority and autonomy in their own life.
Well, Dr. Clayton, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything else about fawning that you want our listeners to know before we go?
The one thing I want people to know, it always makes me a little emotional, is that they make sense. If you have felt like you have lived in this lifetime of why is everyone else figuring out how to have these healthy relationships and it just feels like it's eluded you, or you do feel like you have a sense of I live in chronic shame or hypervigilance, I'm walking on eggshells, there are origins to these behaviors that make sense. And when we can see that, we can finally avail ourselves of tools that allow us not to live there 24/7. That's my greatest hope for this book.
Dr. Ingrid Clayton is a licensed clinical psychologist, trauma therapist, and complex trauma survivor whose work focuses on helping people understand their survival patterns and find their voice. Her new book is Fawning: Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. It's out now through G.P. Putnam Sons. Dr. Clayton, thanks again.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks to you for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, take it.